You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. July 1969, the month that the first people walked on the moon. 12 people walked on the surface of our celestial neighbour between 1969 and 1972. And since then, humanity has been confined to low Earth orbit. There's talk of sending people back to the moon on timescales that vary depending on who you talk to. There's also talk of missions to Mars, possibly in the next few decades, although I'm not going to hold my breath quite yet. But for the vast majority of the last 50 years, our exploration of the solar system has been through our robotic envoys, sent to all manner of planets, moons, comets, and asteroids. Some have whizzed by while others have gone into orbit, some have landed on the surface, and a small number have roved or hopped around. The missions have come from a large number of nations, initially the US and Russia, and now Japan, China, Israel, and Europe, including, of course, the UK, and many more missions are big multinational collaborations. So what does the future hold for robotic exploration? Where are we sending spacecraft next, and why? To find out a little bit about what future missions might hold, I'm joined by Dr. Colin Wilson from the University of Oxford. Welcome, Colin.
Hi there.
So, first of all, there's talk of sending people to Mars in the future, but I want to focus on the robotic missions that we've got there. What kind of missions have we got that we're looking at, and what are the questions they're trying to answer at Mars at the moment?
So there are about six orbiters, by latest count, orbiting Mars. There are three American orbiters, two European and one Indian orbiter. Most of them have cameras looking at the surface, so you can see down to the surface, and some of them can view in quite high resolution. So we've got great maps of the surface of Mars imagery. We're also looking at the spectroscopy, so by looking at different colours, we can identify minerals on the surface and identify regions where there was more liquid water, for example, in the past. And then also looking at the atmosphere to try to understand the climate cycles on Mars. Now this is useful both to prepare for future missions, whether that's robotic or human missions, but also to understand Mars itself and understand, you know, what kind of questions we should be asking there.
So we can do geography on Mars by looking at the surface. We can do geology on Mars by looking at the spectroscopy and looking at the minerals and so on. And then we can do sort of the atmospheric science by looking at the atmosphere. What kind of questions are we hoping to answer about sort of the atmospheric science at the moment?
Well, one of the big questions about the history of Mars is that Mars today is cold and dry. So it can get down to minus 120 degrees or so on the surface, and there's very, very little water anywhere, certainly no liquid water, largely because it's too cold. But when we see, when we look at the surface of Mars, we can see canyons, we can see river valleys, we can see what looks like ancient lake beds. And these are very strong evidence that at some point in the past, there was huge amounts of liquid water on the surface of Mars. So in order to be able to have that, we needed to have a climate at some point in the past where you could have liquid water on the surface of Mars, which means it must have been warmer. And because the warmth comes not because the sun was that much brighter, it must have come because there was more atmosphere leading to a stronger greenhouse warming effect, which would then have had a warmer climate. And it's a mystery as to how that may have happened, because it's quite difficult for climate models to create that sort of climate. So there's two schools of thought. One is that there was a sort of warmer period in Mars's climate. Another one is that these were temporary warming periods when an impact, like a big asteroid, came in and briefly cooked the planet and liberated lots of water. And so those are scenarios which we can investigate looking at the geology of what we see on the surface now.
And is there any, I mean, you say those are the two scenarios, is there a favoured one at the moment? Because I tend to hear about the one where Mars used to be very hot and warm, or warmer and wetter, and has gradually dried off as the atmosphere seeped away. I mean, is the short bursts of sort of habitability, if you like, is that also still in contention?
It's quite tricky. Yes, they are both still in contention, and in actual fact, what we will probably end up with is some combination of the two. You know, warming through impacts is almost certainly important at some early phase of Mars evolution, when impacts were more frequent. And also may have been very important for bringing volatiles, bringing water and other chemicals to Mars. So it's certainly something we need to understand. In addition to looking from orbit, also, I should have rushed in to say that we're also on the surface. So there's the MSL, Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity rover on the surface examining Gale Crater in particular detail. So that's an interesting site geologically because you have lots of layering. The crater has exposed different layers from different eras of geological time. So what would have been an old lake bed and then other layers from different periods. So by studying each of those layers, we're studying different eras of time. But then the newest member of the Mars lander family is NASA's Mars InSight, which is looking even deeper by looking at crustal structure and interior structure using seismometry. So that's studying earthquakes and the way the ground shakes. And although it's a NASA mission, it has a huge amount of European participation in its science payload. So it's a French-led seismometer, but it actually includes two British-made micro-seismometers. These are machined out of silicon. And that's by a team at Imperial College London, but also with strong participation in Oxford. So our own lab got involved in that. And they have detected some Mars quakes. And these Mars quakes will help us to decipher the internal structure of Mars.
And that, I mean, because that's something that we did here on the Earth, you know, decades ago now, is we used the timing of earthquake detectors and so on to figure out how big the core of the Earth was and the mantle and what the interior structure is. With one seismometer on Mars, is that possible on Mars to do that, or does it just give us a better indication? Can we use other models, do you think?
It is. I mean, traditional seismometry on Earth, seismologists on Earth are used to having networks of seismic detectors. And if you have that, then you can identify exactly the source of a quake, and you can trace exactly, you know, the different paths which the vibrations took through the core and reflecting off different subsurface layers. So it may seem at first quite a step down to have a single station, but again, science has got a lot better and scientists have got a lot more capable, and you can listen to the background hum and already make deductions as to what interior structures of Mars could be consistent with what we observe and not. There's a lot of what's called ambient noise seismometry. So you look not just at specific events, but also the background hum, which you get from turbulence and tidal dissipation and things like that. And then also you have impacts from asteroids, meteorites coming in. And we should be able from InSight to detect the direction in which from the lander to those events, and then our network of orbiting spacecraft will be able hopefully to image some of those fresh impact sites, so we can tie it all together that way.
One of the big questions that's hung around Mars for centuries, I guess, is there or was there life on Mars? And one of the ways we can try and answer that is by looking at various compositions of things in the atmosphere, for example, methane. So there's been a big question about methane, a particular gas in the atmosphere, and we've got confusing results so far, haven't we?
Yes. So the question of methane on Mars has been, as you say, hanging around in the air for some time. So if we go back to 2003, there were three reported detections of methane on Mars in the atmosphere. Two of these were from ground-based telescopes, and one was from the European Space Agency's Mars Express spacecraft. But they were very much at the limits of detectability. The next real data source we had from this was when the MSL rover landed about 6 years later and started making measurements of methane very sensitively on the surface at the place where it landed. The story then is basically that there's not methane, except for these plumes of methane. Later analysis, really looking at the bounds of sensitivity, showed that there is probably a background level of methane of below one part per billion, seasonally varying. fast forward to 2019, we have the European Space Agency's Trace Gas Orbiter starts publishing its results. Now, this is a mission which has been designed to be the most sensitive detector of trace gases possible. The first results of that were just published a couple months ago, and they said that even down to sensitivities of tens of parts per trillion, we see no methane yet. Now, that is methane, that's detections from the first year or so of operations at Mars. We have very few observations at the same location as the Curiosity rover. Most of ours are at higher latitude, and many of our observations are at higher altitude as well. But there is definitely no methane down to the tens of parts per trillion level in the trace gas orbiter results. And the latest chapters of that was only last week. There was another detected plume of methane. So this is elevated amounts of methane at the MSL rover. And they detected 21 parts per billion, and then they looked the next day and it was gone. So that again suggests it's very regional and very local, whatever is happening with the methane.
Say we find that there is methane coming from particular regions at particular times, what does that then tell us about Mars?
People get excited by methane because the largest source of methane on Earth is biological. So we may think of mice and cows and things like that as active methane sources. But there's also natural gas from decaying swamps from millions of years ago, which is still biological. But methane does not have to be biological. You can also get it through various geological processes, volcanic vents and things like that. Most of the geological processes rely on having heated water, or certainly liquid water, at some point, probably underground. So even that would be quite interesting, because it would give us some constraints on what's happening below ground and with liquid water. So there are certainly non-biological sources as well as biological sources, but the best way of trying to figure out what's going on is to find out where and when the methane is released, if it's some sort of seasonal process, and then take it from there. On Earth, you can sometimes get constraints by looking at the different isotopes of carbon. So life has a preference for one isotope of carbon that's a different sort of atomic mass of carbon than another. And we do have the capability of measuring that to some extent on Mars, but given that we can't see any methane yet with Trace Gas Orbiter, it'll be very difficult to make any statement about the different isotopic ratios.
Now, looking to the future of Mars exploration, we've got the second part of the ExoMars mission. So Trace Gas Orbiter was the first part. We've got the second part is the rover, the Rosalind Franklin rover, which is going to land in 2021, as I recall. That's going to rove around the surface and actually try and do some astrobiology experiments. What for you even beyond Rosalind Franklin rover, what is beyond that for the future of Mars exploration? What should we look forward to in the next decade or two, do you think? Is it possible to predict what might happen, what you might hope might happen?
Well, the first thing to mention is what's truly new about the Rosalind Franklin rover is that it'll have a drill which can go beneath the surface, maybe a couple meters or even more, depending on how the drilling conditions go. And that'll be a first at Mars, because the surface environment is not hospitable. If you or I were at the surface of Mars, we would die pretty quickly. And even bacteria, which can deal with the pressures and temperatures, would probably die due to ultraviolet and oxidants and things like this. But below the surface, even just a meter below the surface, the environment is much more hospitable, not just for life today, but also for traces of life which may have existed in the past. So that's why drilling below the surface of Mars will be a major step forward in the search for life. But what else is coming up? Well, it's a big international party at Mars. That's what's going to happen in the next decade, or even the next few years, because in the next 5 years, we will also see the United Arab Emirates launch a mission to Mars. There will be another Japanese orbiter going to Mars. So there's quite a lot happening. The new player is entering the game of Mars exploration, and so collaborating and getting all the science communities to work with each other, will make for a much stronger science exploitation of Mars. Looking beyond the 5-year timescale, it's very exciting to consider that there may be private exploration companies, whether that's the SpaceX's or other ventures. We've seen the first private mission to the moon. There was an Israeli company recently which launched a mission to the moon. And it's just a matter of time before something goes to Mars. So it'll be really interesting to see how the government agencies and the private companies and the science community can work together going forward.
And is this going to be a competition? Are we in a sort of, probably a smaller scale, slightly slower version of the space race from the 1960s, or is there much more collaboration now between the different nations and organizations sending missions?
There is a lot of collaboration. A great example of this is the ExoMars program, which is in depth a 50-50 collaboration between the European Space Agency and its Russian counterpart. And so every day we are handing over communications between Russian ground stations and European ground stations, and we work very closely with the NASA ground stations as well. So there's a lot of communication on that front. But the question of cooperate or compete is really important also for China. So all the other spacefaring nations are working together on the space station, so Russia, Europe, Japan, the US, whereas China is going it alone for its own space station efforts. And currently NASA employees are not allowed to talk to their Chinese counterparts in most circumstances. So there's certainly an element of competition between the Chinese efforts.
So if there is an international space race to get to Mars, it's more likely to be the US and China rather than any other groups, you think?
Well, there is certainly a competitive element there. You'll see that in all aspects of the economy, not only in the space sector, but we are certainly, we reflect geopolitical tensions in the space sector, which exist elsewhere, yeah.
Okay, so that's Mars. Let's park Mars for now. We've talked about that a lot. Let's move inwards towards the Sun, and let's go to our other nearest planetary neighbour, which is Venus. Now, Venus is sometimes unfairly treated. It's sometimes called the evil twin of the Earth. It's about the same size, but its atmosphere is much thicker. It's also incredibly inhospitable, but for very different reasons to Mars. And we haven't had many missions, nowhere near as many missions to Venus. Well, actually, saying that, we did used to have a lot of missions to Venus. In recent years, there haven't been as many to Venus. Why is Venus so less well explored, at least recently, than Mars? And what have we found out?
So early on in the space race, then Venus was the first target beyond the Earth-Moon system. So it was the first place we had an interplanetary flyby, the first planetary entry, first landing, and so on. Partly because it's closer than Mars is, so it takes about 5 months to get to Venus compared to 8 or 9 months to get to Mars. Also, it's mysterious. You look at Venus, you see a cloud layer, you don't know what lies beneath, and so imaginations ran wild in the 50s and 60s. And then there was a bit of a space race between the US and Russia to Venus, and Russia clearly won at Venus, so they landed nine or ten missions successfully on the surface. But what they found was that the surface was very inhospitable, and it's 450 degrees centigrade due to a huge greenhouse warming. There's about 90 times as much atmosphere on Venus as there is on Earth, and on Venus it's all carbon dioxide, and that's a greenhouse gas, so you have huge greenhouse warming.
So it's not a very nice place to go. As you say, we have landed on there. The Russians landed some probes there. I think we've had balloons in the atmosphere and so on as well. In recent years, we have had one US mission, one European mission, a Japanese mission go there. So we've done little bits. What have those been looking for? Because they've not really been trying to look at the surface in detail. As you say, it's got heavy clouds, thick clouds.
So the last NASA mission actually launched over 30 years ago, just over 30 years ago, and that was called Magellan. It was a radar mapper, because radar is very good at looking through clouds. You can't take a camera to look at the surface, but you can take a radar imager to look at the surface. And that gave us global maps of the surface. That revealed a very volcanic and tectonic planet. It's almost exactly the same size as ours, unlike Mars, which is half the diameter, and clearly shaped by a lot of the same processes, volcanism, tectonism, and so on. And I guess the reason there haven't been many missions since then is because of the focus and the motivation on human exploration. Since the surface of Venus is clearly an inhospitable place for humans, that's why the focus has turned a lot to Mars, where humans and also robotic rover exploration of the surface is much, much more feasible. But the future of exploration on Venus, one could imagine vehicles, whether that's balloons or otherwise, in the clouds of Venus, because rather than try to survive at the surface where it's 450 degrees centigrade, as you go up in altitude, the temperature drops, as it does on Earth. So in the cloud deck at around 55 kilometers above the surface, there's an altitude where the temperature is about 20 degrees. The pressure is also very similar to what you'd find on Earth, perhaps in the high mountains. So explorers there could, you know, you could open the door of your balloon and wander around on the gangplank and the balconies without a pressure suit, without a temperature suit. You would need a sort of oxygen breathing mask, since there's no oxygen there. And after some time, your skin might get irritated by the sulfuric acid clouds. But other than that, it is one of the most benign environments you would find in the solar system, up at the clouds.
So airships to Venus, that might be the future then.
Airships to Venus. So there are some there's some sci-fi imaginations of this from 50 years ago, but actually now we can consider roving around on the surface again. This was always considered a very difficult thing to do, because none of our electronics, which we're used to, our silicon electronics, none of that would work at Venus temperatures, and the cooling systems to keep them operational are very difficult and expensive. But we are starting to be able to make increasingly sophisticated electronics out of other semiconductor materials. So instead of using silicon, you can use things like silicon carbide or even diamond, it turns out, and you can build up electronic circuits out of those of a similar complexity to what we were using on the moon decades ago. Which is enough to make simple measurements and have long-lived landers and long-lived surface stations. So there may well be a renaissance in Venus exploration on the surface. In addition to that surface thing, I have to say, I should mention the intervening Venus missions since the Magellan mission. There was a very successful European Space Agency mission called Venus Express, focusing on the atmosphere and questions like the superrotation of the atmosphere and the greenhouse warming, and that was operating from 2005 for a decade following that. And now at Venus, there's the only spacecraft there is a Japanese orbiter called the Venus Climate Orbiter, or Akatsuki, and that is now observing the weather and meteorology, and so it's getting great results about those. But one of the most exciting results, perhaps, from the Venus Express mission were the hints of active volcanism. So we know that Venus is covered in volcanoes, but we don't know whether they are currently active. And Venus Express found that the apparent surface temperature at some volcanoes increased sharply and then decreased again. It also found sharp increases in sulfur dioxide followed by slow decreases. This is consistent with what you would get from an injection of this gas from volcanoes. And so there are various hints from Venus Express that the volcanism is active today, the planet is active today, which is what we'd expect given its similarity to Earth, which is volcanically active today. So to try to decipher the history of Venus and also figure out whether it had a more Earth-like past, perhaps even with oceans and so on, we have proposed a new Venus mission, which the European Space Agency is considering now for its next space mission choice. It goes under the name of Envision, and it would take a sort of modern 21st century radar to Venus. So compared to the Magellan mission, which had spatial resolution in its images of about 100 meters per pixel. We can get down now to about 1 meter per pixel to really study the fine scale processes and get us a much better image of what history is written in the geological record of Venus.
So that'll give us a much better insight into the planet Venus and its history. I mean, I guess what's the as we did with Mars, if you had to cast your mind forward, so imagine Envision goes ahead and that goes and studies the surface in more detail with radar. What are the big questions remaining, and what, how do you think we might be able to answer them in the coming decades?
Well, the biggest question of Venus is, was it habitable? Was it once a green and pleasant land like our own Earth? And the community currently is probably about 50-50 split on this. So half of the community think that Venus was once Earth-like with oceans, as well as sort of continental crust and so on, before it then developed a runaway greenhouse effect, and the atmospheric temperature increased and boiled off the oceans, which put all that water vapor into the atmosphere and then cooked it further. So that's one scenario. The other scenario says that Venus would have lost all its water initially before it ever had a chance to condense on the surface. So early on in their lives, Earth, Venus, and Mars would all have had steam atmosphere over sort of molten magma oceans. And while the water at that point is all in steam form, it is much more easily lost to space. And so studying how that happened on Venus would also help us answer why that didn't happen on Earth. So it would not only tell us whether Venus was once a habitable planet, but also tell us something about, you know, our own planet and how lucky we are to have ended up just right.
So there's a lot to learn about the history, as you say, the history of Venus, and possibly what that tells us about the Earth's history as well, and how it got to be the way it is.
Yeah, and particularly since this is an era when we're discovering thousands and thousands of exoplanets, you know, similar planets around other stars. And so as a guide to what we can see out there, we really need to study the planets we can access and study in detail here in our own solar system.
Let's move outwards through the solar system just to finish off, to the only other object in the solar system that's a rocky body with a thick atmosphere. And it's a surprising place. It's one of Saturn's moons. It's Saturn's largest moon, called Titan. It's not far off the size of Mercury, so it's almost planet size. And in fact, I've heard lots of planetary scientists refer to it as a planet. Titan, I find a fascinating world from what I've heard and the results that have come out. It's got lakes of hydrocarbons. It's got it's got hydrocarbon cycles and lakes and rivers and clouds and so on, and lake beds and mountains and so on. It's got an awful lot there that sounds like the Earth, but just with, instead of water, it's got this methane and ethane, these hydrocarbons instead. And with standing bodies of liquid, albeit not water, it's an incredibly enticing place to go and visit. It's just an awfully long way away and very, very cold, and so hard to operate there. But there are plans, and in fact they've recently been announced, you know, firmed up as something that will happen, to go to Titan and explore it more than we have so far. So what can you tell us about this these new missions, or this new mission to Titan?
So this is a very exciting time to ask about this, because we've had the announcement of the selection of the Dragonfly mission by NASA. So Dragonfly is the name for a mission to Titan. Now, this isn't the first time we've been to Titan. In 2004, we had the arrival at Saturn of the Cassini-Huygens mission, and that was an orbiter in the Saturn system, which then deployed a lander to Titan. But this was quite a simple lander. It did all of its science on the descent to the surface, because it didn't know what we'd find. It didn't know whether it would land on solid, liquid, mud, you name it. Whereas now we have maps of Titan, we know it's a fascinating world with lakes and dunes and mountains and possible cryovolcanoes and all sorts. And we would love to explore it, and to explore this varied terrain, we need mobility. But rather than use a rover, as has been done on Mars, we can take advantage of the Titan environment. So Titan has a gravitational force which is about 7 times weaker than that of the Earth. And simultaneously, it has an atmosphere which is thicker than that of the Earth. The atmospheric density is about 5 times higher than that of the Earth. So therefore, it's an ideal place for flying around. So the Dragonfly mission will be a relocatable lander. It is a quadcopter, or in fact, a double quadcopter. It has 8 rotors, and a bit like your sort of quadcopters on Earth, except it's a bit bigger, it's the size of a small car. And taking advantage of the thick atmosphere and low gravity, it can fly around to a new location every couple of weeks. So it's going to sample the terrain between the dunes, you know, in a different crater, old fluvial plains. And at each of these locations, it's going to look in detail at the composition of the surface to understand some of the complex chemistry going on. I mean, you alluded to this a little bit. I mean, there are vast amounts of hydrocarbons on Titan. More, in fact, there are more hydrocarbons on Titan than there are on Earth, which is kind of amazing. Especially on Earth, we have ascribed the production of hydrocarbons largely to the biosphere. So what you find on Titan with a nitrogen atmosphere and all these hydrocarbons may best be described as a primordial soup. You know, this is complex hydrocarbon chemistry. Probably, the kind of chemical building blocks out of which life was created on Earth. So it'd be fascinating to see how far along that pathway to life the chemistry on Titan has come. So not only is it fascinating science with this amazing chemistry and so on and these ocean worlds, but also it is a very cool mission in terms of being this nuclear-powered, completely autonomous robotic quadcopter flying around Titan.
And is that the plan, for it to be completely autonomous? Is there, you know, how much control is there likely to be from here on Earth? I mean, it's a long way away, so you can't fly it with a joystick, right?
Well, that's exactly it. So the two-way light time, that's the time for a signal to come from the camera on Dragonfly to the Earth and for a signal to go back, that is about an hour. That's how long it takes. So by the time you see a rock in front of you, it's too late to move the joystick to avoid it. So therefore, the whole flight of the Dragonfly mission needs to be completely autonomous, all the hazard detection and avoidance and terrain mapping. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, we are scientists. We want to interact with the mission about, you know, where it's going to go and what it's going to look at. So the Dragonfly will go ahead. It'll do some forward scouting and give us lots of imagery of the terrain ahead and then come back to land somewhere safe. And then that gives the scientists on ground 2 weeks to look at the maps and images and characterization of the future terrain and give instructions as to where it should go and where it shouldn't go. But then once you press go, the mission has to perform the flight to that new terrain area completely autonomously. So it'll scout forward to future potential landing sites before returning to the chosen landing site. And making its completely autonomous landing. So it's going to be a fascinating mission. I mean, this kind of mission would not have been possible to propose even just 5 years ago, because autonomous landing of drones and quadcopters may seem like a risky technology. But you have to remember that there has been a huge amount of investment in this field by companies like, you know, Amazon or Pizza Hut deliveries, which want to deliver drones autonomously. And they don't want to have 10,000 drones requiring 10,000 pilots operating them. They want lots of autonomy in those drone flights. And it's also worth remembering that Titan is a much easier place to fly a drone in many ways than on Earth, because the turbulence is lower, the wind speeds are lower. So in some ways, it's a good starter planet.
And so how far is Dragonfly likely to, well, how much distance is it likely to cover? When you say, you know, it's going to scout ahead, is it scouting ahead 500 meters, or is it scouting ahead 500 miles, or somewhere in between? I'm assuming in between.
It will be certainly in between. At first, you can expect everyone to be very conservative. So its first flight will probably go up and look around and come down very close to where it started. Also, remember that since we haven't characterized many sites at all, There's no reason to go 500 miles for your next sight when there's some really fascinating sights to be had closer by. Mm. The nominal mission is going to be 2 years long, which gives plenty of scope for characterizing different kinds of sights. But of course, there's no reason that the mission may not be extended beyond that. In that case, we could actually see quite a large amount of Titan explored. One thing we aren't doing is we aren't landing in a lake or by a lake. The lakes are at high northern latitudes, and they will be difficult to see. They will be impossible to see from Earth at the time when we launch and when we arrive. So we are instead going to go to lower latitude regions, which are easier to see. And we don't have the capability of floating in lakes. So although we will characterize places where there has been flow, we won't be landing at lakes themselves.
So you might look at dry riverbeds, but you won't actually go and try and paddle in a stream with a dragonfly.
I think that would be viewed as an extremely high-risk maneuver, whether on Earth or on a planet a billion kilometers away.
And is that being able to see it, is that just for communications with the spacecraft, with the dragonfly?
Yeah, if you're at a pole which is tilted away from Earth, then you can't see it. There's no relay orbiter, so it's direct-to-Earth communication.
Wow. And when is Dragonfly due for launch? You said, there's a clear launch time in mind. How long do we have to wait for Dragonfly to launch, and then how long do we have to wait for it to get to Saturn?
Well, it's a good thing. I hope planetary fans are patient, because it will launch in 2026, but then it will take 8 years to get there, 8 or 9 years. So we're looking at 2034, 2035 before you see any data from it.
And how big is Dragonfly? I mean, obviously, a Dragonfly on Earth is pretty small. I assume it's is it sort of drone size, kind of tabletop thing, or is it bigger than that?
No, it's more the size of a small car. So it's similar to the Mars rovers, maybe more similar to MSL than to some of the previous Mars rovers. So this is a capable lander. Remember, we don't have to have a lander plus an orbiter. This is, it has to have all its electronics and its communications dish and everything as part of this lander. So it's a pretty capable lander. Mm. And again, if it weren't for the low gravity and the low gravitational force and the high atmospheric density, it would probably not be feasible to have a mission like Dragonfly. So it's the ideal planet for flying, and we're looking forward to doing that.
Well, I look forward to hearing in a decade and a half or so about what it's like to fly around Titan as a small dragonfly. So lots to look forward to, be that Mars, Venus, or Saturn's moon, Titan. Colin Wilson, thanks very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for talking to me.
Don't forget, you can find this episode and past episodes at pythagastro.uk, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.